No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype in your questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. We have a very special guest tonight, Florencia Ramirez, who's going to talk to us about her very important book, Eat Less Water. But first, let me say hello to Maria. Maria, good
Hi.
Evening. You're out there.
Yes.
And let me also shout out to another Californian. You Californians are such great people, Maria. Lucille Ribal Allard, who's a Democrat from California's 40th Congressional District, signed on to our statehood bill, giving us 140 co-sponsors. That's the most we've ever had in the history of a statehood bill. So thank you, Representative Allard. We really appreciate your support. And now, Maria, why don't you introduce our guests?
I would love to. I would like to say first, if I may, that on Thursday I got my acceptance to the PhD program in media psychology, and
Yay!
I will be starting my doctoral studies in January.
Yay!
So I'm super, super, super excited about that. And I'll be the first doctor in the family on either side. So Florencia might be able to appreciate this. Both of my parents speak English as their second language, I should say, did. My dad passed away last month. His funeral mass is this Friday. I have a little bit of an idea of what it's like to be kind of on the outside in that regard. And Florencia Ramirez comes from an illustrious family led by her patriarchal father, who's a longshoreman and still working the docks to this day in his early 70s. So
wow.
she has her siblings and she are unbelievably educated. Florencia was a researcher trained at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy, and in her book, Eat Less Water, which is being debuted on this Wednesday, November 1st. So Florencia, thank you so much for being available to us prior to the publication of your book. I have found it riveting, compelling, horrifying, and you have changed my life moving forward in every food choice and purchase that I make.
Thank you. That actually is exactly what I want to happen with every reader of this book.
And I don't know how it can't not. So if you want to give us kind of a general overview of the book, and then we can go into some specifics about certain products that we think our listeners should know about, because it's something that we consume daily, i.e. coffee, eggs, meat, dairy, that sort of stuff.
Right. So the book, what I do is I look at I chose 18 of our most popular foods, looking at the USDA list. That's how I started out 7 years ago. But it began out of a question that I had after looking at two things. One is that 7 out of every 10 gallons of water in the United States is used to grow food. And the second thing is that the experts predict by 2030, half the world population will experience water scarcity. And we've certainly, here in the United States, are not immune from water scarcity or water shortage issues. So those were the two things that I was looking at answering for myself, because at that time, I was selling shower timers. That was how I was really addressing water conservation. During the last drought here in California, I got in the shower, started to think about my shower time, and then ended up selling 80,000 of them. But as I was talking to people about shower time and how you can conserve water, in a year, 2,500 gallons you can save if you shave your shower time by 4 minutes every time. And it sounds really impressive, right? Mm-hmm. But then as I started to do more research, I realized that we could save that much water in a week or even in a day by our food choices.
Which is staggering to think that that's the case.
And what I talk about in the book, and for some people the concept will be new, it's called virtual water footprint. So everything takes water to make it. So every day here in the United States, we use about 100 gallons of water on average to do the things that we do, like to take showers, to wash our dishes, to wash our clothes, to water our lawns. And that is a huge amount, especially in comparison to, say, South Africa, which is 5 gallons of water a day. But then in addition to that, you and I are eating anywhere between 580 to 1,300 gallons of water every day with the food that we consume. So when I started this work, I thought, well, what can I as an eater make a difference on the two stats that I talked about, the, you know, 7 out of every 10 gallons of water used to grow our food, and to change the story that is not a good one, that so many people will be living without water or without enough water. And the only way that I was, for me, that I was able to answer that question was to set out on this journey to farms around the country and learn from farmers and food producers and ask them those questions. Because I am not, as you mentioned before, I'm a researcher from University of Chicago, but I'm not a farmer and I'm not a scientist. But I think because of those two things, because I'm not those things, I was the person to write this book, because I'm not assuming that the reader knows a lot of these concepts that I learned while I was on this journey.
Well, let me ask you, Florencia, what uses the most water? If we're using 580 to 1,300 gallons a day, I mean, that just seems incredible to me. Where is most of that water going in food products, agricultural products?
Well, in food, so for example, you had mentioned coffee. Maria had mentioned coffee earlier. It takes 2,270 gallons of water to make 1 pound of roasted coffee beans. For meat, 1 pound of beef equals 1,851 gallons of water. A pound of pork is 631 gallons of water. And a chocolate bar is 449 gallons of water. So you can see how easy it is for the gallons to add up. But what I talk about early in the book is this whole concept of green water and blue water. So, and this really helped me early on to understand the difference of what I need to look for when I'm purchasing my food and supporting different farming methods. So green water is what is natural rain. So rain-fed agriculture and dry farmed agriculture, those are things that are where food is growing with rain-fed or with green water. And really 90% of all agriculture in the world is grown with green water. All the agriculture in this country too, but this is the problem, is the 10% of agriculture that's produced using what's called blue water. Now that's the water that we're excavating from underground and from our groundwater tables, are also called aquifers, from reservoirs, from lakes, from creeks. So all the surface water, all that water, that 10%, that is what 70% of all irrigation is using, all of that water. So when you think about that so many that we're slurping up the so much water from irrigation, and as the climate is changing and more farms are going to require that irrigated water, then we're going to have more of an issue of where is that water going to come from.
So one of the things that you point out in the book is that there are certain ways that the folks that you visited with, and Florencia, I believe every chapter involved a site visit with the product that you're writing about. Is that correct?
It is. Yes. Okay.
So she was on boots on the ground with the folks that are doing what we want to promote doing, which is the green water use. But it seems to me that the reason that we don't do that in general is because of the yield and the profitability is greater with using the blue water.
Right. So, for example, one of the first farms that I went to, and the first farmer you are introduced to in the book, it's the wheat and water chapter. That's John DeRosier. So John DeRosier has a wheat farm in Paso Robles, California. Everything around John's farm are mostly grapes and almonds, that grapes that they're growing for wine. They're excavating water. They're drilling 1,000 feet deep to irrigate those crops. John is a dry farmer. He's using little to no irrigation. It's just green water, natural rain and moisture. In fact, on the land that he's growing on, there's not even a water source. So he farms on 200 acres of leased land. And the way that he does that is he uses crop rotation and crop cover. So half of his land is growing the crop, and half the land at any given time has like legumes on it, another part of the crop cover. So I asked him, well, so that means that you're only half your land is only producing something. Why? So you can see now why a lot of the big agriculture is not doing crop rotation or crop covers, because it takes half of their land away. But what he was reminding me is, but you have to remember that I'm farming on land that otherwise would not be considered as farmable land because there is no water source.
So he's actually reaping from something that would have been dormant.
Exactly.
And can you, first of all, can you explain to me the term dry farming? Because yes. I'm a little confused about that.
So dry farming was something that I was confused about too. So rain-fed agriculture is what we see in areas where there's lots of rain, like in the northern part of the United States. But that's kind of like or New York, or where, you know, in your area, Senator Brown, that's a lot of rain-fed agriculture, because it's raining, the rainy season, you have the irrigation you need naturally. But what's happening is that is getting shortened because of the weather changing. And so then as a result, some of those farms are requiring irrigation when before they didn't. But what someone like John is doing as a dry farmer, and biodynamic farmers are doing this as well, is that they are creating soil on their farm that has the ability to absorb water at much higher rates than for other farms. So rain-fed is kind of like a pray for rain agriculture, you know, and if it doesn't, then you're figuring out, okay, I need to figure out how I'm going to get more water, apply more water on this farm. For him, because he knows that he doesn't have irrigation, he's got to figure out how to make his soil become sponges. And the way, and this was not unique to John's farm. Every single farm that I visited, it was always about the soil. How do you build the soil so that the soil does what it does, what it's designed to do, which is to hold water, to keep it, and to draw it down to start to replenish the groundwater. But this is what I learned early on John's farm, is that every time we apply chemical pesticides or chemical fertilizers, we've killed that soil's capacity to hold water. Because what the holding material in that soil are microorganisms. So you can just scoop out like a tablespoon of soil on one of these farms that has soil alive with organic matter, and you're holding about a billion microorganisms in that one tablespoon. But if I go down to the farms that are really close to my home here in Oxnard, California, that are growing strawberries, which you likely have on the East Coast, selling at the produce stand, that land doesn't have the same capacity to hold water because they fumigate it every single time that the crop, you know, is ready to be harvested. They're constantly fumigating the land that's close to me. So not only are you killing the pests, but you're also killing the microorganisms that live in the soil. So guess what? That land is much thirstier. So that has to be irrigated on a daily basis.
So, Florencia, I think a great example of that sponge-like quality that you're talking about is the Benzinger Family Winery. Mm-hmm. And will you share that with us? Because it's a fascinating story about what they did and then they undid.
Yes. So Benzinger, their first winery was Glen Allen. And many of us know that label. Uh-huh. So the Glen Allen, they had all of these experts come out and tell them, which is what you do. Traditionally, you open a winery and you have people, the experts come out and tell you looking at what kind of pests that you might have, what kind of chemicals that you need to apply on your property. So, you know, they did that. They did really well. They had this huge label. And Mike Benzinger and his wife, who live above the property, came out one day to the vineyard and stood there and realized that it was completely silent. There was nothing. There was nothing but great. They did what they were told to do, which is you want to eliminate any other creatures, right? You don't want to have any competition. You just want there to be grapes. Well, they did that, but they had no birds. They had no bees. There was just silence. So that reminded me so much of, you know, Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book. But that was his aha moment, because I would ask every single farm that I went to, that was always my question, is why did you become an organic farmer? That was their turning point. So he started doing research because he didn't want to do it that way anymore. He wanted there to be vibrancy and life on his farm, and he knew that there had to be a better way than that. So he became a biodynamic farmer. And biodynamic farmers, which is also John DeRosier, is a biodynamic farmer too. They, again, it's about cultivating the soil so that it has the capacity to hold water, and also brings its own fertilizer. They talk about the word that they like to use is inputs. So they don't bring any inputs. So for example, again, like the farms here in Oxnard, they're always bringing inputs. So they bring in inputs of water that are being sprayed from the sprinklers. They're bringing fertilizers. They're bringing that in, and believe me, we smell it all around here. We smell it when they bring the fertilizers in. So they're always bringing something onto the land, where these farmers, the biodynamic farmers, are thinking of how is that farm become self-sufficient? Well, it was extraordinary when Mike Benzinger took me on this tour of the farm, and I take the reader with on that same tour with me. And he takes you to the hillside. He took me to this hillside where you can see there was a plexiglass, and you can see the root systems of how far down into the soil. It was like a shaved off side of the hill so that you can see it. And the root systems are going 8 feet down into the soil, into what he called the regolith. There's all of these layers of soil, the bedrock, the regolith. But the very top layer is called the topsoil. Well, so I asked, because I've never seen root systems anywhere else. So I don't know what how to compare that. And so I asked, well, what about all of the surrounding vineyards or what your vineyards were like before? How long are those root systems? And he said 99% of the root systems are in the topsoil. So if you could imagine that, if everything is up in the topsoil, then that plant is thirstier. It's waiting. It's on the topsoil because everything that it's receiving is not from the ground, but rather above the ground, right? It's receiving water from above that's coming from the sprinkler systems. It's receiving the different minerals that it needs, you know, the phosphorus and all the calcium, all the applications that they put on it with fertilizer. So we've kind of created this kind of like drug addict plants, right? That are requiring us to give them what they need instead of them finding what they need in the soil.
So, but Michael, that's why it's considered dry, is because it's not being nourished at the top. They have to go down deeper to get what they need, and they do. And then, as I understand, Florencia, like in your chapter on coffee, that the yield is less, but the beans are bigger.
Right. And that's also the case with the rice, that the grain is bigger. So, and also the grape as well, when they apply less water to it, the yields might be lower, but the flavor is better, and it's also more nutritious. What was interesting, going back to Mike Bezinger, to the winery, is that the wine that is produced, because the root systems are so much deeper, it's drawing in these minerals from the soil that wine that's only at the topsoil doesn't have access to. So the complexity of flavor at the end, when we get it poured into our glass, has a more layered, richer taste. So that's why when I was in the tasting room after we had finished that tour, and he dropped me off with a bottle of wine, and I got to go inside. This is always like the reward of these farms. Yeah. So I'm inside at the tasting room, and I got to go into like the high end tasting room, you know, because they had the two tiers. So it was like the more expensive taste. And so I'm in there and I'm trying this wine and realizing how incredibly delicious it is in a way that I've not tasted California wine. And it occurred to me, something that Mike had said, that when everything is at the topsoil, then the plant, what you're tasting is just the grape. Like that's like the sweetness of the grape. So in California, how we call it fruit forward. Well, really what we're saying is topsoil wine. I mean, you know, that's what it is. So, you know, and that's what I think also when we drink French wine, because the French wine up until recently, actually, they could not apply. Everything was dry farmed in France up until, I think, about 10 years ago. They've opened up a window of time because of climate change, and it's just gotten hotter. So they do apply water to those grapevines, but for 1,000 years they hadn't. But there's still deeper root systems that are coming from Europe. From the wine, so that if you have a bottle from France and a bottle, a fruit forward bottle from California, and have them side by side, you will taste a difference.
Well, let me ask you something, Florencia. Is anybody doing this on a large commercial scale? Commercial farming is very, very big in America. For example, I also was a policy person, and I covered PL 480, which is the farm bill, when I was in graduate school. And there are these corporate farms with tens of thousands, literally millions of acres in some cases. Is anybody farming on that level, or are these all little farmers that are doing this at this point?
Well, that's the issue, is that the larger that the farm grows, the more difficult it is to do these things that I describe in the book. the crop cover, the crop rotation. That's why we see these monocultures. That's why we see just soybean fields on thousands of acres and right. just, you know, it becomes more difficult. These farms require that there's a diversity of what's going on these farms. Most of these farms are not just growing, for example, they're not just growing produce. They also have animals. They also have, you know, they have the cattle, they have the chicken, they have all kinds of things going on because they, in order for that farm to be self-sufficient, they need to have all those things going on because the animals are also part of this crop rotation.
Which you can explain better with the managed intensive grazing systems that you describe, because that's a really good example about how even the hooves in the ground are helping with the culture of this kind of farming.
Right. But before I do that, I wanted to finish about what I do see that is working, because these small scale farmers, first off, are, and you know better than I do, Senator Brown, that these farmers are fighting a system that is a one size fits all system, and it's becoming harder and harder for them to survive.
Yes.
For example, hunter cattle was the meat chapter. And they're located outside of Savannah in, I forget where in Georgia exactly, but they're a fantastic farm, which is using, which you just described, the holistic manage, the rotation system, which I'll talk about in a second. But they will, when they process, say, two cows at a time for ground beef, they're required to have an E. coli test, which is important. And it costs $100. Well, the big dogs, that's what you would call them, the big dogs, they're grinding 30,000 animals, 50,000 animals at a time and paying $100 for an E. coli test. So, you know, and that's just one example of how the rules are built for big agriculture. The little guys are trying to figure it out. Most of them don't have any kind of subsidies. So that needs to change of how can we, from a policy perspective, look at removing barriers for these small scale farms that are saving water at the farm level, which is where we really need to focus our attention on if we're going to really look at water conservation. It's not in the shower, and it's not, you know, turning off the water when you brush your teeth. Those are important things, but that's a drop in the bucket. If we really want to have a meaningful conversation in the United States about saving water, we have to look at how we're growing our food. So,
I would just add to that you're absolutely right about that. When I covered PL 480, which is the farm bill, all these big corporate farmers would bring in the little guys, and they would talk about how the family farm had been in the family for 200 years and how they scratched out a living. But the truth of the matter is there were people like Cargill Grain, and at the time, now this was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, but Cargill Grain, grain from Cargill Grain was used in 6 out of 10 loaves of bread in the United States. 60% of all the bread in the United States in those days was handled by this one company. So the big guys, they're really the key. So that would be my next question from a policy standpoint. What do we do from a public in terms of public policy to make the big guys to get the big guys doing this?
Well, I have been spending more time thinking about it from a policy perspective of what kinds of things. Well, first off, you know, I saw in, I visited an incubator that was giving training for organic farming for some of these methods that I describe in the book, and then allowing them to lease land, like 1 to 5 acres, to get started. Because it costs about $30,000 to start a farm. And through this process, I've met so many people who want to get into farming, but it's so expensive to get into farming. The founder of Facebook started with less money than that. And the returns, their returns will never be at that level. You know, it's just people who want to make a living. But if the structure, the structure of food policy has to change so that it's not addressing this, the size of the farm, because I don't know that the answer is so much of what can we, I mean, there certainly are things that we can do with the big farms. For example, soil probes, which I talk about in the Benziger, the wine chapter, that is an easy way. It's a low hanging fruit of an easy way to drop water use on a farm by 20%, because it's just measuring, the moisture in the soil. So it's just not like, again, in Oxnard, I see how the sprinklers are on a timer system. So regardless of even if it's raining or not, those sprinklers are going on. So 3 o'clock or whatever the time is that they have set, versus a soil probe that's sending information to a computer every 15 minutes and letting them know what the moisture is like in that soil, and not just from the whole, looking at it as like a whole 100 acre block, but rather piecing it into smaller blocks. Because we know even in our yards, in our backyards, we know how one corner of the yard gets more sunlight than another corner, but yet we treat it all like it's the same thing. So that's the same with the farm. So that's like a low hanging fruit of something that as a government, we could have provide to farms of looking at soil probes. But I think that the innovation and is really at the smaller scale level, and it's looking at how do we provide training to these farmers who want to transition, because that's the other thing too is, you know, a lot of these people, a lot of these farmers don't own the land, they lease the land. And so everything that they're doing to build that soil, they can't take with them, you know, so they're, as a tenant farmer, they can't take that soil with them. But so what can we do to help foster the building the soil in the way that I've seen at these different farms, and giving that training to farmers who want it? And mentorship. Like I can see, like I have this vision of all of the farmers that I went to visit in this book, that they would just be like this army times like 100 that are just setting out and going into farms that want them, and to start training them about, yeah, let's, you know, this is how you can, you know, plant this crop cover and do this rotation, and, you know, and this is the rotation schedule that you could think of, like bringing that expertise and exporting it.
But and certainly that's where we as a consumer comes in, to help them drive the profits by us making these choices for our households, because then that would create a more attractive environment for somebody to want to convert over to this sort of farming.
Exactly. We have to make it, there's twofold for me with writing this book as well. Is one is that if you know, like for example, now knowing about biodynamic wine, for example, you understand why it costs more to buy that. Right. Or after you read the meat chapter and you realize that, wow, it takes 6 months longer to raise an animal in the way that I describe with this rotational grazing on the pasture. So it's from a feedlot cow that we all know has runoff issues, that, you know, those cows are eating GMO corn. Like there's so many problems that are attached to livestock animals from the dairy and also from the meat that we're eating. But if it takes a 1 year to raise an animal on a feedlot or a cow on a feedlot, and it takes 16 months to raise a cow on a rotationally grazed pasture, well, because I now understand the difference, I'm willing to pay more for that rotationally grazed meat. And I know what I'm supporting. I'm supporting farmers and ranchers that are saving water, are saving soil, are not polluting our air. Like, I know that that's what I'm supporting. Mm-hmm. But, so by reading the book, us as eaters can seek these people out, because at the very end, I tell you how two of the farmers, I'm not going to say who they are, but two of the farmers are no longer farming. And that, when I found that out, it made me really sad. And I thought, well, should I rewrite these chapters then? Should I go seek out farmers who are still farming and replace it? And I thought, you know what? This is part of the story, because we have to know that we have to work as a team. The eater with these farmers, we have to team up, because these farmers are on the front lines. They're not making a huge amount of money. They're working the land every day. They are at the forefront of water conservation and the food sustainability movement. But we eaters have to support them with our dollars. How romantic that is that they're out there on that farm every day. But I'm going to go ahead and buy this carton of eggs that's $2 cheaper.
Well, you know that, but isn't that the reality that we face here? One of my favorite things in Washington, D.C. is that we have very few hardware stores anymore that you can go into and ask somebody a question. You know, I'm one of those do-it-yourselfer kind of guys, because the big box stores, the Home Depots and those places, came in and they sold stuff cheaper. And I just read last week that this may be the oldest store in America. It was opened during the Revolutionary War. It was a hardware store in Massachusetts, I believe. And they're going out of business next week because they can't compete anymore. I mean, isn't that what we do? I care that I pick up my coffee in the morning and it tastes good. And if I can buy it for $5 rather than $7, how do we change people's minds on this? It seems to me that the challenge really is going to be in supporting this at the farm level rather than at the consumer level. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I think it has to happen at every level. I'm looking at it. I first address it in this book from the individual level, because there's so much power in the collective. There's power in the collective, but we have to merge our influence. So if you know and I know and my neighbor knows and we're going and we're asking, we're emailing, we're asking the big guys, like, how are you watering? Are you using a rotational system? And could you imagine if they were receiving like 10 of these, 15 of these, 30 of these questions about what kind of irrigation they're using? I think that they would start to wonder what's going on and start to listen. And I came across a study that showed that it surprised me, because it was talking about how it is the consumer that has the most influence over the board of directors, over policymakers, over employees. It is the consumer. But we have to know what we're asking for, right? We have to know that, one, that it's important, and we need to know what to ask. So that's what this book is doing from the consumer level, is what can we do to merge our influence so that we can create change, from the small vendors to the large vendors.
Well, and that's what this program's about, Michael, right? Grassroots politics and activism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a big mountain, though. I mean, that's the problem. It's a big mountain to climb. But I would think that people, that if you could get people organized and motivated, people like the people of California, who are always seem to be facing some sort of water crisis, if you could get them organized and motivated, yeah, you could do something. But this is agriculture is a big, big, big mountain.
Well, and but it's not just that too. Florencia talks about an egg or a chicken operation in Texas that has 25,000 hens. That sounds pretty big to me, Florencia. I'm sure it's not like Zaki Farms, but that they're making a dent with the green eggs, right?
I love that farm. It's Coyote, I believe it's Coyote Creek Farm, just outside of Austin. It's a larger pastured, rotationally grazed operation in the United States. I think they have 10,000 birds, and that was growing. And they were going to open up a second farm. I don't remember where exactly. It wasn't going to be in Texas, like in Georgia or something. But because they recognize that there's only so much how big it can be in one place before you can no longer do that type of farming.
Right.
So what they do, it's incredibly intentional grazing. This is the same thing that's happening at hunter cattle as well. So you could do it with cattle, you can do this with chicken, any ruminant animal. So they carve the land into patches. So the hens are in a house on one patch of land, and they're great. They're growing all kinds of different grasses that are good for the bird, and then therefore are going to be good for us when we eat the egg. And after, depending on what time of year it is, they move the hen house when they're all asleep at night. They move the hen house from one patch to the patch next to it. And it's all fenced off so that the birds can't overgraze. So I, like, for example, a lot of people who have backyard chickens know this. When your backyard chickens are in one spot, it's not moved, what happens to that grassy area, or what was once a grassy area? It's become dirt. Mm-hmm. Those chickens will eat every single thing. They eat the root. So that is not good for soil erosion. That's when runoff happens. You know, there's when you have these open patches of earth. That's what I would, every single farmer I'd go to is like, they do not want to have any open patches of earth. That's where it's like, as soon as one crop was over, the planting started with the next one, and you don't want to have those open patches, because that's where you start to lose the nutrients of that soil. That's when it starts to run off into that stream and then cause what, you know, dead zones in our rivers and in our ocean. So they are rotating off these chickens off before they have the chance to eat down the grass. And they don't rotate them back until that patch has been replenished. Like it's grown back and it's ready for them again. And in that way, they don't even have to irrigate. And I was there in the summertime. It was so hot and humid, but they did not have to irrigate any of that land because, again, the soil is ripe with those microorganisms, and those chickens are fertilizing that soil. So it's all part of this natural system, this rhythm that we have. Now, that's what's going on too with the cattle, with these rotationally grazed cattle. When I first began this process, I really thought the answer was grass-fed beef. As I got, I actually wrote that chapter twice. I went to a farm that had the animals on, I believe it's like more than 100 acres of land. But they, you know, it was very romantic. Like they were underneath the oak trees and climbing up the hillside. They had beautiful view, even ocean view. Like they had beautiful views. But as I started to visit more farms, and I kept thinking back at that, what I saw that day, and realized that, yes, what was going on at that farm is better than a feedlot situation, because they're not having to irrigate the land. But because the grazing isn't controlled, there was no fencing. One, the cows require a whole lot more land, and that's not a sustainable solution. And the second is that they're trampling all over everything and also overgrazing. So that particular farm has to move them. They have to gather up all the cows. And after the grazing is finished on that farm, because they've eaten everything down, they have to move them 100 miles to their second farm and put them on that patch, on that pasture. But if they had just fenced off the areas and put it into paddocks, I wonder if they would have had to rotate them off that land, but rather just rotate them from one patch to the next patch to the next patch. And what it's creating is what, you know, what you had mentioned earlier is with the holistic management, this whole notion of duplicating what naturally would have happened in nature is that these animals, these grazers, could never overgraze any area because you have predators coming behind them. So they're not going to just linger and watch the sunset in a spot for 7 months. It's just not, it wouldn't have been possible. But now, because we don't, we've eliminated a lot of the predators, they can.
Well, let me ask you, what do we do, again, as a policy? I mean, I'm a consumer. I'm concerned about this. How do I know what to buy and what not to buy?
Yes,
as
exactly.
As a public policy thing, do we require some sort of labeling? You know, I'm a diabetic, and I can tell you that my life has been changed by the fact that I try to stay on a low-carbohydrate diet, and now everything's labeled. So I can tell that I'm on it, you know, instead of guessing at it. Is that what we push for from a policy perspective, labeling food so that people understand what's more sustainable and what uses less resources to develop?
Well, for example, like, how do we know that they're green eggs? Or how do we know that the coffee is understory shade grown, which you point out in your book, or the wine biodynamically? That's because it seems like it takes a lot of due diligence on the consumer's part, and that's where the break is going to occur. Nobody's going to make that effort.
Right. I do love that idea of labeling. Could you imagine going into the store and seeing the meat and it saying rotationally grazed?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and
I mean, if there's a benefit to the producer to do that, you may be able to get them to do it voluntarily, like free market coffee or whatever that is, where, you know, that's become so popular these days. You know, if there's some, for example, with the wine, when you talk about the wine being better tasting, the California wine, I would think that that would be an incentive to consumers right there to have a better product. And maybe you can get the producers to label stuff, or should we require it as a government? We're dealing with this right now with GMOs.
Well, and we have fish that are labeled farmed or line caught or wild caught.
Absolutely.
I think that would be a really interesting way to tackle the kind of where you're saying, to so that there isn't the break between the consumer trying to figure things out. I mean, I do these eat less water dinners where I go to people's homes. I've done a handful of them, one in Brooklyn and another in Oakland. I've been cooking all over. And what happens is that we all gather, they choose recipes from the book. I show up, all the recipes are there. They've already done their homework. So part of it is like, you know, part of the homework is go find biodynamic wine, go find dry farmed wheat. So that's already, before I even show up, there's already been some learning there. And so I was at one in Oakland and we made quiche, and everybody, and the reason I do this is really kind of that grassroots, like Cesar Chavez meeting, the house meeting models of, okay, let's organize in the kitchen. Like, you know, this is where it's at. It's about the food that we eat. And I don't want to just read to you from the book, but I want you to experience it. So that's what I'm coming at with these dinners. So I'm there, and one of the women at the Oakland dinner tells me, she's like, I just need a list. Can you just give me a list of, like, who should I be buying from? Well, I mean, I don't live in Oakland, so I can't tell her, where she should be buying from. I mean, I can tell you, Maria, where you can be buying from.
I know. I'm looking forward to that. I don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Right. Well, maybe you should apply for a government grant to put together a database to do that. Because wouldn't that be a great thing for consumers if I could go to eatlesswater.com and pull up a list of local vendors that I could deal with? I would think that would be very useful.
Yeah, that would be a really useful guide. But what I told her is this. You don't have to do it all at once. Let's say you start with eggs. Let's start with the livestock. You know, if you are eating meat, start there. And, you know, so start asking the questions for your eggs, like, you know, and find your egg source. And that's it. Once you find that person or that farm that you want, that you feel good about supporting, you're done. You don't have to do it. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time you go to the grocery store or go shopping every week. And then say next month you find that coffee that that you want to support and are using these techniques that save water. And then the next month you're going to look for who's going to be your supplier for beef or chicken. You know what I mean? So just taking it piece by piece. Not all at once. And
that makes sense.
Research.
To break it down.
Yeah, it's done.
The other thing that Florencia alluded to that I would like to mention again, too, is a lot of the chapters have recipes based on what it is that she was talking about, which is also fabulous because they all look delicious, too, on top of it. But so you're making things from the items that we should select. And I'm thinking, Michael, that Mrs. Brown might be interested in this.
Yeah, Mrs. Brown might be interested in this. She's quite a good cook. As we speak, she's cooking dinner. So I'm going to go up and query right after the broadcast where she got her eggs and where she got the rest of the stuff.
But here's the other thing. I'm sorry, Michael, is that I don't know that we have the verbiage that we need to ask the questions to get the answers that we're looking for.
Right.
Because I didn't know about green eggs until I read your book. And all I knew was Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs and Ham, you know.
Exactly.
So how can we empower people to know what to ask to get the answers to make the choice?
Well, the you know, when you read the book, you heard it's the genre I wrote it in is creative nonfiction. So in other words, it's storytelling. And I chose to do it that way, to write this book that way, because I want you as a reader to hear my questions. So you know how there's that dialogue between me and essentially I become a character in the book, and mm-hmm. all of these farmers are characters in the book. And sometimes the animals become character, like Jolene in the egg chapter becomes a character in the book. But I did that because then you can listen to what my questions are and then think, well, I could ask that question. That okay. wasn't a hard question. I could go to my farmer's market and ask, what kind of irrigation are you using? I can go and ask, is this a rotationally grazed chicken farm, or is this a rotationally grazed beef farm? And could you imagine, I know from experience, when I go and ask these questions, because I have been now for the last 7 years at farmer's markets, that, you know, how when they are using these techniques like dry farming and holistic manage, the ones that you're going to learn when you read the book, that they are so thankful that somebody knows, like understands the value of what they're doing.
And the sacrifice that they make to do it.
Yes. Because
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, we're running out of time here. So I'd like to know if there's a website or something that people can go to, not only to find out more about this, but to get copies of your book.
So the book is available anywhere books are sold as pre-order.
Okay.
So Amazon, Barnes and Noble, your independent bookstores. If they don't have it on the shelf, they can get it for you. And the book goes on sale November 1st. you could go to my website, www.eatlesswater.com, and just, while I have recipes on there and the event list, I'll be in Miami presenting next month for the Miami Book Fair. And I have, if you live in California, Ventura County, I'll be with my books at Leashless Brewery Brewing, which is our only 100% organic brewery in the 805. And I don't even know what we have in LA. I'm not even sure that we have 100% organic brewery in LA. But that we're going to have a celebration that day on Wednesday. And I'll be there with the books. I'm going to read excerpts from the book. And well, we can all drink beer, organic beer. And there'll be two recipes cooked that night from the book, the spent grain burger and the Mexican chocolate cookies, and offered for sale by Farm and Flame. And that's the other thing, is that not only supporting our farmers, but supporting these chefs and restaurants who are incorporating local sustainable foods on their menu, because they are buying a lot more food than we are in for our own kitchens.
Good point.
So we also need to, they're also part of this.
Good point.
Well, I think everybody that's out there listening should go. I mean, chocolate chip cookies, beer, what more could you want?
They're actually, TASA is the chocolate farm I talk about in the book,
uh-huh,
of Boston. So it's TASA Mexican chocolate cookies using their stone ground Mexican chocolate. They're really fantastic. But that, if you can't get to Ventura, California by Wednesday, you can bake it on your own in your own kitchens with the recipes I provide in the book.
And I'm going to be there. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And these are a handful of recipes I put in the book, but every single recipe that we make at home can be modified to save water. It all comes down to, who are you purchasing your food from, and how are they, what are they, the methods that they're doing to save water, to build water resources on their farm? And that's the partnership that we as eaters need to engage with. We need to engage with those farmers, because there is power in the collective. We will rewrite the story of water on this planet.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Florencia. This is such an important issue. You've been a great guest, and I hope you'll come back so we can talk more about this, because, we face more water shortages around the world and more people to feed, it seems that we need to develop better ways of doing things, and Eat Less Water may be a guide to doing exactly this. So good luck with the book. We hope you'll come back soon. Maria, do you want to add anything?
I just think that the light bulb went on for me. It's not just our kitchens, but as you said, Florencia, the restaurants that are doing it, that's multiple kitchens, so there's even more power in that choice. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. And continued success, and so proud of you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And thanks to our listeners to always making our program a part of your week. We really appreciate it.
We do. And this song that we're going to play as we go out goes out to our guest, Florencia, who'll stop the rain. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote.